Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Wednesday, the 4th of September. Coming up on the programme, Herman Mashaba's flip-flop on his previous working relationship with the ANC, while MK gains ground as the party snaps up more municipal councillor seats. We look at some useful statistics around South Africa's booming Kasi economy, why employee shared value ownership schemes could be a creative solution in a low-growth economy, and e-sports set to be the new kid on the block at the next Olympic Games. Never let it be said that politics in South Africa is boring. As a result of support from the ANC and other parties, Action SA's Nabuhle Mthembu has now been elected as Speaker at the Johannesburg City Council. And then, in a slew of recent by-elections, the Umkhonto weSizwe party has seen its second ward councillor elected as it turned the tables on the ANC and the EFF in Rustenburg in the northwest. Commentator TK Puer is with us. And first of all, what does Action SA's decision to collaborate with the ANC in Johannesburg actually indicate about shifting political alliances?
Well, I think it shows that Action SA now is playing the game of politics. If you'd remember, I think for the last 3 years or so, Mr. Herman Mashaba has, you know, vehemently said he'd never work with the ANC. But I think the shifting stance post-elections have sort of shown him that you need to play with other players that you not necessarily like. But I think the bigger question would be, you know, his red lines, because it's one thing for you to take this action. It's another for you to have to justify this with your members. And it's going to be interesting to see how far Action SA members are willing to go with this, understanding that, look, very much like the DA, if you paint the ANC as this monster, you better make sure that you control the monster.
Was this always about Herman Mashaba just putting a stick in the ground, a stake in the ground, or was it something that resonated deeply, do you think, with his base, his constituency?
I think it's a mixture of both, and I think the key overriding thing probably is a democratic alliance. I think Mr. Mashaba's party didn't do as well as he had thought it was going to do, and he, in a search for relevancy, and I think there's nothing more relevant than kind of saying, listen, we're kind of taking a bit of a twist by working with the ANC. It sort of keeps his party relevant, and also it keeps the DA, you know, on their toes. And it's a one thing probably which we thought had simmered down a bit, but I still think there's still some tension between the Action SA and the DA, and this sort of puts the DA in a very awkward position, as we saw last week in the city of Tshwane, where literally it's almost a split. One might say that the people might like the mayor Brink, but he might be a casualty of Action SA starting to say, listen, we can also play a bit of politics, and that the DA might have to also rethink a bit how they treat Action SA going forward.
So going forward, as far as the ANC Action SA partnership is concerned, it will be tricky. Do you think that there is enough political maturity for them to work together, particularly in or for the benefit of the ratepayer in Johannesburg, who has become increasingly frustrated?
I think it's actually a very, very small circle. There's only one thing that could really make this work going into the upcoming elections in the next 2 years, which is there needs to be a drastic turnaround in the city of Johannesburg, and Action SA needs to be able to say, listen, because of us, this has happened. But this is going to require that you kind of assist the ANC and, you know, obviously help the ANC not be what the ANC is, which is a party which has been bundling the city of Joburg for the longest time. So the only success heading to the election is Action SA needs to be seen as having been a party which has saved the city of Joburg, and ratepayers need to say, listen, we can pin this turnaround on Action SA. That the ANC has got the mayorship will be coincidental, but I think for Action SA, this is the only recourse its members and also voters will probably give it, and I think that's quite a dicey predicament. So it's almost a bit more dicey than even the DA at the national level, because you literally, Action SA is pinning its hope on being able to control the ANC for the betterment of the city, And that's quite a gamble to take.
Let's reflect on this raft of by-elections that we've seen in the past couple of days. We now have an MK ward councillor in Rustenburg. Is there any specific significance about that, particularly, again, in terms of these ever-changing political sands?
Well, a joke, on a side joke, I think he probably could be the longest-lasting MK official, because I think for him to be, I don't think he can quite recall a councillor, so that might be a record of sorts. But I think it does speak to, look, for them, it's a big win, especially in a non-KZN Mpumalanga setting. It kind of does show that perhaps the party is making inroads in non-traditional MK places. But the key thing would be, is that, is this a once-off, or can they build upon this? Because the key issue they'd want is to say, listen, heading up to the next election, it's a build-up to many other things, and that this councillor has to be seen as almost being a harbinger of the success. And I think it's a great thing for them. They might argue that, listen, it doesn't come from KZN. And it'll be interesting to see how many of these types of things happen. Because if this is a trend, if you are the ANC, if you are the EFF and other such parties, it's not exactly the greatest news that you look forward to seeing.
And it does obviously signal a broader trend of emerging political players challenging established parties. And that was self-evident in the general election.
Yes, I think I term this, we're in an era, what I term political deconstruction, which is to say political creative deconstruction, which is to say we're seeing new actors come to the fore, and it's not necessarily as though voters are in waves voting for this change. Some of them stay at home, some of them are just simply tired of the status quo. But again, it's always an issue of saying it's one thing to be tired of the status quo, and it's another thing when you give the traditional parties a bit of a bloody nose. Again, it'll be interesting, to what effect does this go to? Because if it's an issue of saying, look, we're angry at the traditional status quo, that only lasts for a few weeks, a few cycles. But I think the bigger issue is, can the party that you're putting in, can they maybe say, listen, you've given us this vote, we want to do something different? And I think that's always been a bit of the problem with giving the many new parties that come into South Africa, is that they get given a chance, because South African voters clearly have no problems voting for new parties. The issue is, can they deliver? Because you can only do this for so long before voters become disenchanted, as the voting turnout is showing us that people are becoming disenchanted. So again, it's up to these new actors and players to be able to kind of do things differently.
And talking about disenchantment, we've seen the Democratic Alliance lose in eThekwini to an independent candidate. And there's also the row about the hiring of ostensibly an alt-right person by the leader of the Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, as an advisor in his ministerial office. Problems for the party.
It's problems which they sort of foresaw it, especially when it comes to, I think, looking at by-elections. I think they were quite happy post-election. I think that first month after the election that they were able to retain and get some seats in places like the Western Cape. KZN, it's a bit of a shifting sand situation. But again, maybe it kind of has all come full circle now that the issue of the minister Steenhuisen and his choice in the cabinet. Almost like they are purposefully, or he's purposely doing this, where people has sort of lived with the idea that, listen, Mr. Steenhuisen is not the greatest leader the DA has had, but he's someone they can live with. But this is a bit of an amateurish mistake to make, and almost gives parties like the MK and even the EFF and voting fodder to say, you see, this is who the ANC has gone into bed with. So in as much as I don't think it'll damage the DA's core supporters, there might be a bit of a tip, those of them who are termed classical liberalist, but I think the bigger damage could be on the ANC, because now people clearly say, but listen, you literally are in bed with people that are inviting such individuals. How do you almost live with yourself? It'll be interesting to see whether the party comes in the form of Miss Helen Zilla, because they still haven't even sorted out the Mr. Host situation, because I think he's been on is a suspension for the longest time, and now you have this situation. So it'll be interesting. I think in a way it harms, yes, the DA in the short term, but I think it really raises a few questions for the ANC, and a lot of people are now going to say, but this is who you're in bed with. It's just going to start another cycle of I don't think it breaks this coalition government, but I think it does sort of add more fire and a bit of reluctance to those who want to see it work.
I always appreciate your crisp analysis. TK Puer, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, according to Stats SA, around one quarter of South Africa's population live in townships, and with that comes a vibrant economic sector often referred to as the Khasi economy or the hidden economy. In 2023, research estimating that this sector could be worth close to 200 billion rand. The digital marketing agency Roger Wilco, alongside research partner Survey 54's latest annual Township CX report, is due out in October, but senior brand strategist at the agency, Mongezi Mtati, has agreed to give us a sneak peek at the latest findings, and he joins me now. Mongezi, first of all then, how are consumers in this important economy, I wonder, adapting to new online shopping platforms compared perhaps to the general economy?
Over the years, Jeremy, what we keep seeing time and time again is that there has been a lack of trust quite a lot between, I suppose, the township economy and ordering online. And this is, of course, due to all the things that we keep hearing about, fraud, identity theft, and all of those things. But year on year, we see that there's a change in how people are adopting to shopping online. This year, for instance, we asked what factors would make respondents shop more online, and people are citing more payment methods. And if you think about the fact that we talk about the unbanked quite a lot, even though we don't talk about that as much anymore, 21% of our respondents say more payment methods would make them shop more online. Another area that comes up quite a lot, which doesn't, I suppose, come up a lot in suburbia, is something about delivery to the home, that last mile delivery, because some e-commerce platforms have cited a lack of, in some instances, addresses or not knowing street names or not knowing the township as much as they know other areas. So 19% of our respondents have said delivery to the home would increase their likelihood to shopping online.
But these e-commerce purveyors have got to come up with a strategy, surely, to overcome that, given the importance of the market.
Absolutely. And in some instances, we've seen that some have, like, I mean, one brand to cite, I suppose, is Spar, with their Spar to You delivery, where I know that, I think in places like Amanskraal and Tembisa, they've partnered with Delivery Gaspeed, which is a township-founded delivery platform that understands the township. So some brands are adapting to it, and I think I've seen that Take a Lot is doing one or two things in townships as well. So there is this adaptation that we are seeing by e-commerce platforms in some instances, but it's not enough, or at least the perception by the communities is that it isn't enough. And if there was more of it, they'd be likely to shop more online.
To what extent is this trend being driven by younger shoppers?
In very many instances, it is. I think the younger shoppers, shoppers in their 20s to sort of their mid to early 40s are driving this quite a lot because they like the convenience. And a lot of the time, we tend to see the township in isolation, whereas people in townships travel, they experience things outside of the township quite a lot. So if you work in Sandton and stay in Soweto, you know what you experience in Sandton, or you work in Greenpoint and you live in Khayelitsha, for example, you know what you experience in Greenpoint, which is different from what you experience where you live. So this, I think we are starting to see that people who live in townships don't see themselves as living in a township in isolation. The brand experience and the experience that they expect of brands is also informed by experiences that they have outside of their localities.
And to what extent has the digital adoption that we've been talking about within the Khasi economy impacted the operations of informal traders and, I guess, sponsor shops?
Quite a lot. So what we saw, I think, coming out of COVID, I know we don't talk about COVID anymore, but what we saw coming out of COVID is that because people weren't traveling, the local economies in these townships were also adapting. So they were looking for ways to deliver. They were looking for ways to engage and interact. So in very many ways, even though they don't use the traditional formal platforms that e-commerce is known to live on, they use platforms like WhatsApp to deliver groceries or a basket of groceries to a home that they know is nearby. So this adaptation is happening quite a lot, and it's happening a lot of the time outside of traditional platforms where we're able to measure it. But when we ask people what they're doing, you realize that they're adapting to this digitalization where some of them are connected in the home, and some of them, of course, use mobile data to do so. But we are seeing that this digitalization is really influencing how people are shopping and how the stores themselves, spaza shops, and all the rest of it, engage with the customer.
And that's a prime example, is it not, of one of the key drivers behind the ongoing resilience of this Kasi economy?
This is true. This is true. And what we are seeing as well is that in some instances, even though brands aren't really responding quickly enough to it, the Kasi economy itself is making strides. I mean, there's a brand called Gcwalisa, which really enables people to bring a container to come buy, be it maize meal or flour, at this store, at one of their stores. And really, the idea of it is that you refill whatever it is that you want to get to use at that particular instance. So, in some instances, you're seeing that if brands don't respond, the Kasi economy does and creates alternatives.
And leading on from that, and a final question then, are there new lessons that formal retailers can learn from the informal sector's success?
Absolutely. Quite a few of them. So, one of the things I think that informal retail sometimes does is give this feeling, or at least perception, and sometimes it's real, where they help to develop, they're seen as helping to develop the economy. They're seen as helping to develop the township. And when we ask our respondents this year if they believe brands keep their promises, over 40% of them felt as though brands don't keep their promises. They either partially keep them or don't keep their promises at all in helping to develop the communities. So a big lesson for brands here is that in a world where the trust deficit between brands and consumers is increasing, they're not doing themselves any favors by not keeping promises in these townships that they operate in.
I'm going to leave it there. Mongezi Mtati, thank you very much indeed from Roger Wilco.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Employee share ownership plans have been underused as a galvanizing factor for economic growth in South Africa, according to Bruce Hunt, the managing director of Transcend Capital. Now, employee share ownership, or ESOPs for short, have become something of a compliance and empowerment tick box, but according to Hunt, could play a bigger role, a greater role, in creating lasting shared value across various sectors. And he joins me on the program now. So, Bruce, firstly, then, how can ESOPs be leveraged as a strategy for economic growth?
It's quite interesting. If you look around the world, employee ownership is quite prolific, and you see a number of different states actually use tax incentives to encourage employee ownership. We don't really have that in South Africa. And what's interesting is when you look to go and see why they choose to do it, and they're not looking at transformation like we are, which has driven ESOPs to date. They've looked at how it actually increases the competitiveness and the productivity of businesses. It also makes quite a huge difference in terms of building cohesiveness into the various communities. And I suppose to a very large degree in South Africa, we've built ESOPs just on black economic empowerment. And what is the quickest way we can look to kind of do things? And I suppose when I think about this and I look at some of our clients, you get like a listed industrial client, I'm afraid, can't quite name them, who's in a turnaround phase. And they go, we've had a really rough time. We haven't gotten the business right. We haven't been aligned. A new CEO comes in and says, I believe that we can build this company together. We can be aligned to it. We can do this as one team. And how can we use employee ownership to do that? So everyone can share in those gains and feel like they're part owners. And if we can get that kind of thinking into our businesses, where everybody's playing the same game, going in the same direction, we can certainly see increases in growth. And in that company, I'd say there's a 50 or 60% increase in share price over the last, let's say, 4 or 5 years.
Why do you believe that cohesiveness is so important in creating, as you suggest, a more inclusive and competitive business approach?
So I think if we look at South Africa, we certainly have inequality to a very large degree. And there's also quite a large pay gap. So often when you see companies turn around and you look at what CEOs earn and the gap between the highest and lowest kind of worker, and the company does well and the CEOs and all the execs and shareholders do well and the workers don't, that certainly doesn't seem to make sense for long-term sustainability. So if you can actually get more of that cohesiveness together where people feel they're playing the same game, we really are starting to move into the shared growth type mentality and the shared value type mentality.
You're also asking, or you would be asking, employees to share in the risk of the company as well and the downside. And not everyone's got an appetite for that.
So I think when it comes to employee share ownership, when we talk about sharing in the growth and shared value, we can't expect employees to write checks out and be in a negative position. There are already a huge amount of challenges just on a day-to-day basis for many employees, even more senior people in the business. So when we're talking about the shared value and the shared growth, you know, people may get nothing if the company doesn't do well, but if company does do well, they participate in it. And that's how senior execs are also remunerated as well. You don't often see the senior exec write checks out for their options if they don't work, but they may end up being out the money. So the downside is not participating very well if the company doesn't do well, but it doesn't mean actually having to write a check out.
Mm. How do you sell the notion to people within a company to make sure that ESOPs are simple and easily understood across all levels of the organization? Because you'll concede there could be a degree of either concern or confusion.
I think it's even worse than that. I think there's a large amount of distrust as well. So we've been doing ESOPs for the last 20 years or so in South Africa, and we often work with companies and they'll go and say, great, we've had an employee share scheme, and the employees have gotten nothing. And now we want to do a new scheme. The people don't trust it. So when we look from in terms of how you're looking to design it, you need to take into account where the company has been. Has value actually been delivered over the period? And how do you actually communicate it in the simplest way possible? And there's been quite a huge growth or move towards what's called evergreen type schemes. So in other words, a move away from one day, if you're lucky and the company does well, you'll get your money in 10 years, to participating closer to the actual annual profitability of the company, but not a profit scheme. So it's how do you make it more real and tangible where people can see those benefits as they accrue or get paid, as opposed to being very, very long term.
Is there a specific way in which ESOPs are structured to maximize impact both on business and the broader community? And obviously mining springs to mind. Is there a different design in that respect to make sure that everybody beyond just the company benefits?
I think when it comes to ESOPs, there's two things. There's partly what the structural corporate finance type design is, which we'll deal with in a second, but it's also the philosophy of the managers and the owners of the business who put it in place. So if the owners are, let me just do the bare minimum I can do so I can be compliant, it's never going to make a difference, no matter what the structure is. But let's assume people have the shared value approach. You know, we really want the employees to benefit. We want them to understand. I think there's been a huge move to understand that historic ESOPs were when were you lucky? You take Kumba, people made fortune. They made 500,000 rand in the first scheme. You'd then get other commodities where they'd make nothing. And that was all around the structure, right time, right place, leveraged investment. There's a huge move towards what's called evergreen type structures, where people get a larger dividend and potentially less capital gain at the end of the period. And that builds the trust, makes it more sustainable. And I think it's that kind of structuring and design where things have moved to very aggressively. And you're seeing that in some of the large structures. You're seeing it in the Anglo structures. You're seeing it in the ShopRite structures. And I think that's definitely where things are going.
Bruce Hunt, I appreciate you shining the spotlight on this. Managing Director, Transcend Capital. Appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, the 2024 Olympic Games will go down in history for many reasons. The spectacular opening ceremony, incredible record-breaking moments, and Australian breakdancer Raygun. While skateboarding and breakdancing was included in the sports extravaganza list for the first time, all in a bid to connect with younger audiences, the rumblings seem to indicate that we might not see these disciplines included again. But don't despair. Ever evolving, the International Olympics Committee has now voted to include e-sport in the roster starting next year. Now, I'm no expert in the field of online gaming, so we've called on Tristan Renz, who's the general manager of locally founded e-sports organization Bravado Gaming, to shed some light. And Tristan, first of all then, why do you believe the inclusion of e-sports in the Olympics is going to succeed?
Yeah, we did obviously see that. And I honestly, as a gamer, a lifelong gamer, I think the inclusion in the Olympics it's absolutely massive for the industry. I think what the Olympics brings to esports that it definitely didn't have before is an audience that maybe didn't understand what esports was. I think for the younger generation, it's quite obvious in the size of the market of esports globally across the world, and especially in the last 5 years since COVID especially. I think for the younger generation, it offers them an opportunity for a lot of the younger guys now who might not be interested in being a long distance runner or a high jumper, or, you know, they, at the moment, a lot of the younger generation are interested in esports, and this gives them a legit opportunity to show that esports is becoming a professional career. And I think esports in the Olympics is just going to solidify that.
And for the uninitiated, when we talk esports, what exactly are we referring to here?
You know, when people ask me, what does Bravado do and how does esports work? The best analogy that I always like to give is I compare it to a football team, right? You can look at a Man United or you know, the Springbok team or... But what esports is, and as Bravado Gaming, how we act together with our sponsors, obviously Alienware, Dell, and Intel, we act as a kind of a ground for all of these things at once. So I always say you can think of it as a football team that has a rugby team, a swimming team, a tennis club, all kind of wrapped up in one. Esports offers people a lot of different options. That's, I think, something that makes it very different to traditional sports, is that esports has options in terms of, you know, 5v5 first person shooter games, all the way down to very tactical 5v5 games such as League of Legends or Dota, and those kind of options, especially on a platform rather, like the Olympics. I think that gives it an opportunity to really level up the opportunities across the board. So not just as a player or a coach. I think that's kind of the traditional way that people see, especially athletes, is that you either are a player or you're a coach, and those are kind of the only two careers. Whereas in esports, there's much, much more than that. Obviously, there's the entire broadcast talent, people, you know, who are shoutcasting the games as they happen, people on the broadcast itself. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of opportunity in the Olympics, and esports as a whole is definitely growing.
And, and Tristan, beyond the Olympic Games, just in terms of the setup or the paradigm itself, there's a lot of money in this activity, is there not?
Probably one of the first questions that I get asked is, you know, what does the money look like? And I'll just give you a good example. A 5v5 shooter game called Counter-Strike. It was one of the big annual events that happened about halfway through August. And I think there was about $1 million on the line on a streaming platform called Twitch. There was about 277,000 live viewers. You know, I think in the last 5 years especially, there's been a lot of growth in terms of that, just based on, I think, the market share that you could say esports is taking over compared to, you know, not even just traditional sports, but compare it to industries such as the movie and entertainment scene, all of that kind of stuff. Esports is definitely growing more in terms of value.
And as far as South Africa is concerned, do we have the talent and do we have stars?
Well, definitely. And I think that is obvious in kind of all of our sports, right? Is South Africans do have a chutzpah. And I think especially in terms of esports, it's something that Bravado Gaming really tries, and we've spent the better part of 15 years focusing on, is kind of taking that African talent to the international stage and proving that we do have that talent. At the moment, we've actually got a project with one of our CS2 teams. They are currently in Serbia, competing out of Europe, competing competing for us, competing for South Africa. And that's exactly what we're trying to prove. We're trying to prove it on the international stage. We're trying to prove to everybody once again that South Africans can compete. It's just a little lack of opportunity. That's the only difference.
I'm sure you ask this question all the time. The growth in esports is phenomenal, as you've just indicated. The money is also quite staggering. But there would always be concern about the health and well-being of young gamers. How does the sector, how does the industry address that particular problem?
Oh, well, again, I think, you know, the joy of esports being a little bit newer and having so many traditional sports that we can kind of, you know, take certain things and certain guidelines that we see in traditional sports, like sports psychology, dietitians, all that kind of stuff. And honestly, in esports, when it first began, I don't think that was a focus, right? It's exactly how I think everybody kind of pictures what gaming and esports is. It's people sitting behind their computers for 15 hours a day and kind of just withering away, you know? But I think the professional side and the, you know, the professionalism of esports has kind of proven that there's a lot more to it than just spending time behind the computer and being good at a game. You know, the 5 to 10% that makes people champions and actual athletes is how do they eat? Are they sleeping well? Do they look after their relationships? Are they getting enough time outside? Are they exercising? All of those factors, we're seeing it more and more, especially at the top echelon of esports. Those are the factors that really make the difference.
Health might be one thing, but hacking is another problem. How critical is cybersecurity in protecting the integrity of these tournaments and the safety of players, and particularly as this now becomes part of the firmament of the Olympic Games?
Oh, it's definitely massive. And I think there has been, you know, like in anything, there's different ways that you know, that side of life can definitely find its way in. But like I was kind of making mention to earlier, the beautiful part about esports is there's so many careers. And I think what you're seeing, just to kind of stray off a little bit to it, is what you're seeing in schools with a lot of the universities and schools bringing on esports clubs. It promotes kind of the future of what the generation now is. It's the technology generation, you know, and in esports, when you're bringing in that influence, I don't know, it pushes the kids to also get into all the other sides of it, which are coding, robotics, cybersecurity. And those are all career opportunities that are also growing within the industry that might not have even been around 5 years ago. So I think with the introduction into the Olympic Games, it's just going to professionalize it more. You know, those opportunities for cybersecurity careers are just going to explode and become more in demand, like we're seeing with basically any technology career at the moment.
Tristan Renz, thank you very much indeed. And just before I say farewell, on our online poll today, we've been talking about employee ownership schemes, and I'd like your view. Do you think they are overrated or underrated? If you have a view, an invitation to go to our poll either on X or on LinkedIn. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.